This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Please welcome Ed Gorman and John McCarthy.
Well, thank you all. It's marvellous to see so many people here joining Ed and me, and also on this extremely unpleasant day outside. It's nice and warm in now that we're in the Olympia Centre. It's a great pleasure and a privilege indeed to be here with Ed today to talk about his life, but particularly about his book, Death of a Translator. Ed is a journalist and writer. He worked for the Times newspaper for many, many years as an editor on their news and foreign desks. He worked for them as a sailing correspondent, as a Formula One correspondent, and indeed as a foreign correspondent and a war correspondent, which is where he started out his life. Now, his book, Death of a Translator, is a remarkable account of that career. And it starts with his very first foray as a reporter, not to cover the goings-on on the local council or the magistrates' court or the church fates that many young journalists start out on, but in his mid-20s, he headed out to Afghanistan in 1985 to cover the war between the Soviet-backed government and the Mujahideen rebel forces at that time, but without any experience. I don't think you'd even published an article at that point, is that
right?
No,
I hadn't.
So why and how did you come to be doing this?
I don't know. I always had a feeling that the most exciting and challenging form of journalism would be to cover a war. And I was young, I was very ambitious, very reckless. And the war in Afghanistan at that time was very different to what we've seen since. It was very underreported, very difficult to get to. And most newspapers were not sending correspondents on their staff to cover it because it was too... to start with, it wasn't particularly high on their news list, but also it was a very difficult assignment to cover in a short time. So it was a perfect war for freelance journalists, and quite a lot of journalists who've gone on to become quite well established in the last 30 years or so started by trying to do what we were doing then.
So how did you go about that? As you said, obviously it's an extremely remote part of the world to get to, very difficult terrain, I imagine, which you'll tell us about how to move around in that terrain. But also sort of making the connections to get into a war zone, which wasn't well covered. And, of course, there weren't mobile phones, satellite phones in those days. All that technology.
Yeah, in those days, in the mid-80s, Afghanistan was very underdeveloped indeed. There were very few roads. There were no communications of any kind. As you say, no phones. Absolutely, satellite phones had not been invented. Well, I think the very first ones were just coming in. But Afghanistan was a real backwater. And, of course, it was occupied by the Soviet army, which meant that if you were going to travel inside the country, you had to stay away from the main paths and the main routes. And some of you will know that Afghanistan is a spectacular country which has considerable variation in its landscape. So there's large areas of desert, which is flat in the south. But in the north, you get into the foothills of the Hindu Kush range. And the walking is really tough. And quite apart from the dangers of covering the war, the actual physical challenge of Afghanistan was phenomenal. And, of course, because it was a country at war and because you were in there illegally, there were very high risks in terms of you could fall or get sick. And the problem was you'd have to walk all the way back to Pakistan again to get any treatment. And, of course, a lot of the Mujahideen guerrillas who were injured in fighting in Afghanistan died not from their wounds immediately but because they couldn't get back to treatment in Pakistan. And actually our first experience as we walked into Afghanistan was seeing wounded coming out on horseback, which actually was a very moving and disturbing experience. But just to quickly fill in, the way you did it was I sort of went to see a few newspapers in London, got letters of recommendation, they didn't know me from Adam, and sort of had them in a plastic folder. And then I headed out to Peshawar in the Northwest Frontier Province, where the guerrilla groups had their offices in exile. And basically the idea was you'd go along and say, you know, I'm a very important young journalist, I'd like to go inside. And then they would try and arrange a commander who was willing to take you in.
And eventually you found someone who would do that. Because I was just thinking, you obviously mentioned the Hindu Kush there, and many of us, I'm sure, will have read Newby's wonderful book, A Short Walk in the Hindu Kush, which is an amazing, almost an elegiac sort of description of that remarkable terrain. But you were going in, perhaps with memories of Newby in the back of your mind, but seeing the same landscape but under totally different circumstances. What was that like? You mentioned seeing wounded Mujahideen soldiers coming out, but the terrain itself hard to walk over, but in constant danger of war.
Yeah, it was a very sad experience, actually, to experience what Eric Newby had seen, I can't remember, 30 years earlier. Because Nuristan is one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's a very mountainous area with gorgeous villages made of stone and timber houses, small farmhouses, and a peasant rural economy where the farmers would terrace all the fields. And they grew a wide variety of vegetables and fruits and lived very much like we would in the same area. And, of course, when I went in there, though, I came across one bombed-out village after another. And I'm sure Eric Newby would have been utterly shocked to see what had happened. The Russians were using... Sorry, I should say the Soviets were using their classic scorched-earth tactics, which was to destroy the entire environment that the guerrillas were trying to operate in. And the idea being that if you destroy their means of their livelihood and their food resources, then they won't be able to fight the war. So we came across one village after another that was bombed to smithereens. And at that time, most of the inhabitants of those villages were already in exile in Pakistan.
So obviously some of the men were staying, mainly men, clearly, who were in the guerrilla forces, the Mujahideen. Their lives had obviously changed from being, as you say, farmers, effectively from a timeless era.
Yeah.
Suddenly that world had been literally blown apart.
Yeah.
They were staying on to fight. And so they'd shifted from being, I don't know, teachers, doctors, farmers, to being tooled up guerrillas.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I was 24 at the time. I'd been brought up in Warwickshire, which I don't know any of you are familiar with. But to me, it was just extraordinary to come across these ordinary people, wonderful people, tough, determined people who wanted to stay and fight, protect their land. And actually, I remember thinking, you know, what would I do if my village in Warwickshire was invaded? You know, would I run for the hills or would I stay and fight? And you know, it's very easy to leave, but actually in these cases the families had gone with the children, and that's actually another story, because those children, the boys especially, grew up in the Taliban generation. They grew up in refugee camps in Pakistan, but left the men to fight, and some of them were armed with old 303 rifles that their forefathers had used to fight the British. And we used to come across old chaps who said, I know where you're from. And in fact, one guy said, I'm going to kill you because I need to avenge the death of my grandfather.
At the hands of the British Army.
Yes. And I had to go to the commander that I was with and say, look, I think this guy
needs a talk.
He doesn't like me. But yeah, so it was an incredible sense of just to see a population at war. And one thing that I hope my book does is give a sense of who the ordinary Afghans are, because they are wonderful people, and in the last 30 years they've had a very bad press.
Yes.
And actually, you know, they're not all religious extremists. They're peasant farmers, a lot of them, very solid people.
So you actually were there at a time seeing not only the physical devastation of the social communities, the villages, the towns, etc., but also a beginning of a change. Not only were much of the population in the war areas, conflict areas, going into becoming refugees and living across the border in Pakistan, etc., but there was a shift in how society worked with the radicalization, as you say, of the Taliban and the jihadi element coming in of Islam.
Because essentially what happened during that first war, when the Russians, the Soviets invaded, is the Afghans turned really to their religion to fight the infidel invader, the godless invader. And the mullahs became incredibly important. And in a very short time, the population was radicalized. And even by 1985, so 5 years into that war, the people that I was traveling with were pretty full on when it came to their religious observance. And what I found when we were in situations of danger, being attacked or under fire, as it were, very unnerving, some of the young boys would actually run towards the enemy rather than away, which was an extraordinary thing to watch, because what they wanted to do was become martyrs. And I can tell you that is a very unnerving experience to undergo, because you're assuming that everyone is trying to do the right thing and protect themselves, and you suddenly realize they're not. So again, that was a very interesting and unexpected element of being in Afghanistan in those days.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like when, not when you were under fire with your escort of Mujahideen, so to speak, the people you were going in with, but just what is it like? So having read The Newbies and now read your book, there's this extraordinary sense of going into this wilderness and the hardship of literally having to walk everywhere for miles, up and down, and yet at the same time, something still magical about the beauty of that wild space.
Yeah, I mean, it was as a form of travel, I would say it was the ultimate travel experience, bar none. It was a completely immersive experience. You were with people that you had to totally trust. And in fact, quite a few journalists met rather sad ends because the people they went in with turned out to be they were murdered effectively, or robbed and murdered. So there was a huge element of risk. You were with people from a completely, as you say, a completely different culture. They were at war, which is a war which was very difficult to understand. And of course, I was also very impatient to get on and do what I wanted to do. And I wanted to see stuff and report it. And I'm sure a lot of you know that it's famously said that 99% of war is sitting around doing nothing, boredom, and 1% of it is sheer terror. And those kinds of wars, counterinsurgency wars, are very much of that ilk, because stuff happens very occasionally and very unpredictably. So you can't, you know, you often don't know where you're supposed to be.
So you went in with the first trip, you were travelling with a friend, James Blunt, who likewise had just decided, I think it's going to be a great idea to be a news cameraman.
Yeah.
And you thought, yes, and I'll go and be a news reporter. So both of you, really, in a way, naive in terms of ingenues, in terms of any experience. And you went in on that first walk into Nuristan, you came out and then realised that you wanted to get closer to the action, so to speak, as you say, you were young and eager and frustrated not to. And then you linked up with a Mujahideen leader whose base was much nearer the Afghan capital of Kabul.
Yes, there's a fantastic, charismatic chap called Niazuddin, whose guerrilla band were based in the mountains southeast of Kabul. And actually, from the top of the ridge, you could look down and see the city in the distance. And their sort of specialism was doing hit-and-run attacks inside the city. So the idea was they would go in, which was an extremely difficult process, which we'll probably come to. They would launch attacks on either Afghan army positions, who were the communist Afghan army, or on Soviet camps or guard posts and so on, and then come back out again. So it was very much the center of that war and very high risk in terms of trying to cover it.
Going in with them, did you feel that, obviously, as we were discussing earlier, these were amateur soldiers, effectively. They'd only come about it, I think, Niazuddin sold jeans in Kabul before
the war.
Yes, he
did,
And most of them were farmers, etc., peasants, whatever. So this was a kind of ragtag army, in a sense. But did you feel that you were with a professional... Not only were they dedicated to fighting for the homeland, so to speak, the motherland, but were they a unit you felt secure with in terms of their military abilities?
Well, I've mentioned their sort of crazy behaviour under fire, so that was one element. But yeah, you're right. I mean, they were incredibly committed, and for them it was a matter of real pride to be able to take a Western journalist into the city and bring him safely back out again, because it showed that the resistance network in the city was operating at a level that the Soviets couldn't deal with and weren't able to detect. So a lot of it for them was prestige. And you have to bear in mind, at that time, there were 7 main resistance groups, and they were fighting amongst themselves all the time for preeminence, and also they were in a constant battle to see who would get the best weapons from the CIA through the Pakistan Army. So if Niazuddin, for example, could show the world that he could take a journalist into Kabul, he could get me back out again alive, it was a big feather in his cap. So there was a lot at stake for them.
It's interesting because you obviously put your life completely on the line in his hands or the hands of his men when you were moving around with them. But I'm intrigued because you talk about a lot of the characters you met, one or two who you became friends with, and Niazuddin, even though he only had a tiny bit of English, I think, but through translators, you formed a very close bond with this guy.
Yeah, I found him very compelling. He was, a very charismatic, good-looking guy who ruled his guerrilla group with a rod of iron. He had reached the top of the command tree because he was the most successful of the, and command had been handed on by his dying predecessor. So it was very much, you know, he was the big cheese in the group, really. And I, young Englishman, I sort of gravitated towards him. I felt very secure in his presence, and I trusted him, which, of course, I had to do.
Because it was, in fact, only 6 or so years older than you, I think, as it happened. And so then he says, I'll get you into Kabul, which would be an amazing coup for you, but as you say, for him, in terms of prestige and convincing the West that there is a serious rebel force that can take on the might of the Soviet Empire was important. Reading that account, and I was rereading it the last couple of days, I read the book last autumn, for the first time, and reading it, I felt as if I was sitting with my daughter, who's 13 and loves things like The Hunger Games and the Maze Runner films, these kind of dystopian sci-fi movies where you're trying to get into the capital. And that seemed to me, looking at it, you lived that for real. The journey from the mountain retreat of Niazuddin's camp, going down across the plains, through the front lines, and into the city. Can you share a little of that with us?
It was... I had no idea what I was really going to take on. And it was only when we tried to do it, the first time we tried to do it, we actually ran straight into Soviet armor. And we were then bombarded for 3 days and three nights non-stop. We then had another go. And what I discovered was that Kabul at that time was essentially a military camp. And it was surrounded by concentric circles of security. And in order to get into it, progressively, we had to walk, first of all, at night on open plains with helicopter gunships overflying us with infrared and using flares that would turn day into night. It's very bad for your heart rate, so anyone with a heart condition, it's not a great thing to be doing. And then after that, we would go through all the outlying villages, and then we came to a ring of guard posts where you had to my astonishment, they had floodlights, just like Second World War movies, where you have to run between the floodlights, wait them, lie on the ground, wait for the floodlight to go past, get up, sprint. And there were also sound detectors. I think they were sound detectors, but they may have been mines. I don't know. And the whole thing just went on and on and on. And every time I thought we were getting there, we had yet more to go through. And at one point, I describe in the book how we were hailed from one of the guard posts, and people often talk about your heart exploding in your chest. I have never experienced anything quite like that. The jolt of adrenaline, because you're essentially waiting for someone to open up with a heavy weapon, and that would be it. And but then when we got into the city, because I'd been in the mountains with these guys for about 5 weeks, something like that, it was an incredible
at this
experience.
Point, although you'd gone in with your colleague James and an American journo, they'd gone off to do something else. So you've been on your own in the camp, and I think without a translator for much of the time. So it was extremely lonely, and now you were alone, essentially, surrounded by your Mujahideen colleagues, in a way, going in right into the heart of it.
So the difficulty I had was the guy who was translating for me was killed by a helicopter gunship one day, which I describe in some detail. And as John says, the difficulty I had was that I was doing all this really without an ability to properly communicate. Yeah. But I was kind of committed to it, and I felt I was brought up rather annoyingly with this thing of, you know, if I've started something, I'll finish it. And so I kind of went through with this. I probably shouldn't have, but I did. And yes, as you say, it was difficult. But once I got into Kabul, I then had an incredible experience of, as I mentioned before, this resistance network of living in safe houses. It really was amazing.
And the people you met there, the guy who was Zulmai, who was, yeah, who was your host, if you like.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, he was risking everything. There were little boys running errand messages between the various groups, the safe houses. But not only had you had the heart-stopping moments of terror of getting in, you then got dysentery as well. And, yeah, and they kept putting you in a hole in the ground for, yeah, your safety, admittedly. But, it's...
Yes, they were... All the safe houses were constantly under surveillance.
Yeah.
Because the Russians and the Afghans knew... They had a rough idea, and unfortunately, the guy that I... who hosted me in Kabul was shot about... He was killed 6 months after I left. So they knew roughly where they were supposed to be looking. But it meant that if you were in one of these houses, the army would be coming through on security sweeps continuously, and they would come through the garden gate, because they had big, high walls that I think you will have seen in Afghanistan. And I used to be quickly squirreled away into hiding holes, which are exactly like the kind of priests' hiding holes in the 16th century in England. And you would be, for example, in one of them, there was like floorboards that lifted up, and I would go into a black area underneath, and then the boards would be put back in a rug, and on the top of the rug was a huge pile of mulberries. And I literally heard the soldiers walking in to the room above me, and when the thing was pulled back again, I wasn't actually certain who I was going to see next, so... I mean, experiences that you can probably relate to.
Well, indeed. I mean, I was just actually having the heebie-jeebies. some of our audience may have just that sense of claustrophobia,
yes,
you know, which I did have badly after my time in Beirut because, yeah, of the confines, but also when we were moved around.
Yeah.
Not through the terrifying... Well, there weren't battles sometimes when we were moved, but because we were being moved by our captors,
yes,
and would be bound and gagged and blindfolded, etc. So that element of terror, if you like, albeit yours was sort of voluntary, you were in a situation of not being able to get out, because you could, because, you know, you would be killed either by the enemy or in our cases by our captors if we tried to escape, or could just get blown up randomly, yeah, in a sense. So that really does touch a chord with me. But what you did was this wonderful thing that, having suffered all of that, you then did fulfil your journalistic mission and the prestige mission for Niaz al-Din by getting dressed, getting rid of the Mujahideen costume, the Afghan clothes that you were wearing most of the time, and dressed allegedly as a young Soviet army officer and drove around in a jeep for the day.
Yeah, this was... I mean, it sounds completely ridiculous, and I agree that it was. But Niaz al-Din's idea was that if I wanted to see the city, then I needed to see the city. So his plan was, one of his guys was an Afghan army soldier. He was an Afghan army soldier, but his brothers were Mujahideen guerrillas. So it was a very, very sort of, yeah, flexible situation. And this soldier's job was to drive a Russian officer around. He was at his beck and call. And he was like his Batman. And essentially, they organized for me to be that Russian officer. And we drove around the city on the most extraordinary tour of Kabul probably anyone's ever done, I think, probably. And we got away with it, luckily. Because I think if we hadn't, I might still be there.
Yes.
But it's interesting, just picking up a little on what you were saying there, I think a lot of the long-term problems I developed as a result of these experiences was actually not so much what happened, but it's the threat all the time,
yes, yes,
that you don't know what is going to happen. And in some ways, looking back, maybe a lot didn't happen that could have happened. But the thing that plays on your mind, for me anyway,
yeah,
was always that sense of the unknown and not quite being sure where you were and what was going to happen next to you.
I think the fear of not knowing what was going to happen next, I think, was probably, if I look back, the most traumatic experience. Obviously, yeah, some bad things happened, being kidnapped, being physically bundled around, being beaten up on occasions. But I think it was that weird thing of... I was locked up for just over 5 years, but it was that sense of at any moment, A, they could burst into the room and drag us out, tie us, yeah, up, chain us up. Maybe they'd beat us up, but more likely it would be a move to another place, and God knows where that might be. What was the journey going to be like? It was always very uncomfortable and, yeah, very frightening. So you were... or they, you know, they might come in and that might be it. They just come in and and shoot you,
yeah,
for whatever reason. And I think, I look at it now, it was, and this was obviously the way you've been describing it, perhaps very similar for yourself, the sense of living constantly on an adrenaline rush. Mm-hmm. But particularly in our case, there was nowhere to go.
Yeah.
So it's almost as if literally a lot of us, we were just lying down in these tiny cells chained up. You're lying down and your heart is racing because you're just waiting. What's going? And it's an incredibly wearing experience,
yeah,
you know, because you can't burn any of that energy off. And you couldn't even express it much. At least I often had companions I could talk to. At times when you were on your own, even with, you know, benevolent companions in the Mujahideen,
yeah,
you couldn't communicate with them or say, what's happening next?
Yeah.
Or you could, but they wouldn't be able to explain it to you.
Yeah, I think one of the unique elements of covering the war in Afghanistan in those years was you could not get away. So, you know, even in the Beirut Civil War,
yeah,
for example, or the Balkan Wars, which I covered later on, there was always a taxi to jump into and probably a hotel around the corner because, you know, war actually happens only just around the corner and everyone else, everywhere else, just carries on as normal,
yeah,
most of the time. But in Afghanistan, you were completely, as I say, completely immersed. You couldn't get out. And you were very much at the mercy of the people you were with. And my experience went on and on and on. It ended up being a very long trip inside, which, as I've suggested, did lead to some quite long-term consequences.
Because it's really interesting, and that is an important part of the book, particularly towards the end of it, of how you came out of the experience, and you've gone in, obviously, to be able to tell a good story,
yeah,
spread the word about what was happening to Afghanistan, but also account your discoveries, your adventure to a degree, but your experiences. And yet, whilst you could do that in some level in adventure, to actually talk about what you've been kindly sharing with us this morning, which is a potted version of what is obviously far more deeply expressed in the book, was you found really difficult. So you sort of carried on back to Afghanistan, covering other missions deep inside the territory, to the Balkans, as you say, subsequently to Northern Ireland, as Asia correspondent for the Times, you covered conflict in Sri Lanka, etc., etc. All over the place, you were going, almost, you know, you kept going back to the danger, and yet, reading about it, and this really strikes me, and I haven't been back to, I mean, apart from Israel-Palestine, which obviously can be volatile, I've never really thought I would go back to somewhere full-on war zone as I did when I got kidnapped in Beirut during their civil war in Lebanon. But you kept doing that, but it seems increasingly that was becoming more and more of a really big strain for you.
Yeah, so what I didn't realise, so this, the main events that I've described happened in 1985, but I carried on working as a conflict journalist or a war correspondent for nine long years afterwards without realizing that I was suffering from incipient, what is now, I think we all now know, something called PTSD. And the really amazing, the thing that astonishes me really most about my story is that in 1994, I could not find a doctor in London who knew what it was. And now it's just a household name. Everybody knows what PTSD is. So you're right. I mean, I kept on doing the worst, very worst possible thing for my condition, which was causing me waking nightmares, night terrors, sweats. I was suffering continuous stress in my mind and my body from what had happened to me. And, of course, going to somewhere like Sarajevo during the siege was just like digging about 30 needles into an open wound. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, maybe this is just the normal thing, you know, you're covering a war. And, of course, you're always surrounded by people who are a lot worse off than you are. So you don't particularly rate your own state. But eventually, I got to the point where I just couldn't continue anymore. But having walked out of my office, it took a year for a doctor to work out what was wrong with me, which, as I say, I find really quite amazing.
Well, it is interesting, too, because, funnily enough, Ed ended up being treated at a hospital called Ticehurst in Sussex, is it?
Sussex,
yeah. And the head of the organisation is Dr. Gordon Turnbull, who I'd met when I came out of Lebanon, because he was in the RAF at that point, leading a team of psychiatrists, and they were developing PTSD. They were developing it really as a means of getting service people back into action or to overcome things. This is at the time of the first Gulf War, etc. And so that they were developing that. And then in civilian life, he carried on developing that with other colleagues. And I found meeting him, and it was all very much, I was sort of being debriefed. I was, you know, kept to an RAF base, well, not kept. I was guests at an RAF base immediately coming home, and talking to them was a huge release. But that happened to me straight after the end of that experience. Whereas, as you say, you didn't talk about it. You kept going back, literally, into the fire, so to speak. And that maybe that bottling it up, not only was it a terribly traumatic original experience, built up. So whereas I was lucky then, in a way, sort of let it out. Just on that thing, we've both written books about our experiences. I wrote mine within a year of coming home, which I co-wrote with my then fiancé, who campaigned for us, Jill Morell. You wrote yours many years later. I found it cathartic. Did you?
Yes, absolutely. And I have to say, it is amazing to be here with John, because I remember when Gordon Turnbull diagnosed me and said, "You've got a rip-roaring case of PTSD, and I want you to come to my residential 2-week treatment down in Sussex." But I remember the big sort of calling card was that he had treated the Beirut hostages. And so here we are. But the person we should have
sitting with us. Here we are on a travel show. You're talking about the terror of walking across the landscape, and I'm famous for sitting on my bum for 5 years, going nowhere at all. But anyway.
But anyway, the bottom line is, you're absolutely right. Writing a book was incredibly cathartic. And as you say, it took John a year to sit down and write a book, because he's obviously very disciplined. It took me 28 years to do it. But it's been a fantastic way to encapsulate what happened to me and to understand what happened and put it all in perspective and give it a beginning and a middle and an end. And actually, it's helped me to move on in life a lot, and also value life away from that sort of work.
Well, I think it's interesting. We were talking, and I mentioned that Ed was for a long time the sailing correspondent for the Times. A huge jump in a way, but a sensible one that you made, I think, emotionally as well as intellectually, away from being a continuing on the foreign desk or as a war correspondent. And that's something that we both... I hadn't been a sailor at all before Beirut. Subsequently, was able to learn and had my own boat for a while. But I think there was something very special that I sort of intuited, just had, and many of you who are sailors would perhaps understand that too, of just being on the water and feeling that sense of the wind and the water working together, and you guiding this craft across the surface of the planet in a little way. That sense of control, absolute control of your own life and destiny, and it's all up to you. So it's kind of a big responsibility and can be quite frightening, but at the same time it's you, but it's so natural. And the calming sense of being in the water, on the water and using the wind, that's clearly something I think that you share.
Yeah, I found sailing incredibly therapeutic and relaxing. And in fact, some psychiatrists have said that they believe being on the water is a very calming influence for your brain, the right side of your brain. And actually, the other thing we have mentioned, I had done a trauma course at the Times when I was deputy foreign editor with Marie Colvin, who also was a passionate sailor. And actually, we spent 2 days really just comparing notes on our sailing adventures, while we were supposed to be concentrating on management. But
of course, she tragically died covering the more recent conflict in Syria. And lots of colleagues will have done. You know, that's it's a terrible thing that journalists have become targets as well. You know,
well, the sad thing is, in the story of my book, almost all the Afghans that I write about were killed subsequently. And I quite like to go back to that, because it... We're talking about trauma for us, but actually it's Afghanistan that is the trauma case. I mean, in my view, it's a whole country that's turned into a case of... they've been at war now for 40 years, I think it is, and there's no end in sight to it. And if one thing I hope my book can do is sort of give a portrait of who these people really actually are, rather than who we tend to read about in the press nowadays.
Well, you do that very clearly, and I think very strongly, that come across that this is a beautiful country, rugged and wild, with lovely people there who have been devastated by invasions from the Soviets, or previously from the British, and then more recent invasions, etc. The civil war between the warring factions, which, as you say, still continues now. And yet, at the heart, they're like us, you know, making the best of their life, or trying to make the best of their lives. Yeah. So that they're not crazy, fanatical, you know, Islamic terrorists or whatever it might be, but they're a proper culture and a decent society.
And they're also very lost, I think, because decades of war have accelerated social development in Afghanistan in a ludicrous way. And, you know, even when I was there, the first JCB diggers were arriving and they were blasting roads through the rocks, you know, because they needed to get food and weapons in. And then a lot of very well-meaning Western aid organizations came in, bringing medicines, bringing education programs, women's rights programs. There's nothing wrong with that. Bringing democracy as we see it. But none of these things are actually Afghan, how the Afghans want to live. They have their own traditions, their own way of doing things. And I feel in a way that they've become very confused, and billions of dollars have been spent there, and we're not really sure how much of it has been use, really.
Well, I realise we've got a few more minutes, but I'm sure people would like to ask questions. I've been hogging the microphone, so to speak. If anyone does have a question for Ed, or indeed perhaps for me, that we have the lovely Roddy over here with his roving microphone, as he likes to call it, if anybody has questions.
Oh, there's one. Gentlemen, there.
Ed, you said that you formed quite an emotional bond with the people that you were with in Afghanistan. Did you feel that that was a positive influence on your reporting, or was perhaps some sort of constraint on your reporting?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, actually, because later on, a few years later, I went into Afghanistan with the Soviet Army, which was a very interesting perspective on what I'd been doing before, and I actually met a Russian journalist, and we spent a fascinating few days together in Kabul comparing notes. And he'd obviously reported the war from their side of the story, which was they were doing their international duty. They'd come to support a client regime in trouble. They thought they were doing the right thing. And he regarded the guerrillas as a bunch of terrorists and mercenaries who were fighting for money, the lowest motives. And I, of course, had described them as freedom fighters in my copy. It's interesting now to look back, and I feel comfortable with what I did. I think I'm not sure if he does with what he did. He went on to become Vladimir Putin's spokesman for a while, so it would be an interesting conversation. But I tried to, even when I was obviously young and malleable, if you like, I did try to remain as sort of objective as I could. You know, not everything that they did was good by a long chalk.
When you went back the second time, did it ever cross your mind that you may be captured again? Were you frightened? Or?
So when I went back the second time, yes, you always, whenever you go to cover a war zone, you never quite know what's going to happen to you. There's always that underlying chaos that you're entering into, and all the best laid plans, you know, can go out of the window very quickly. So yes, it was always in my mind that it was, you know, something bad could happen. And I actually travelled with other guerrilla groups in years subsequently inside Afghanistan during the Soviet war, but luckily I didn't end up being captured.
Thinking of that, I didn't go back to Lebanon until a long time. By the time I was released, the civil war had ended, thank God. And I didn't return to the country for many, many years. 10 years, I think it was. But I went back, and although it was absolutely peaceful, and although I'd made, through colleagues, it was to make a TV program, close connections with Hezbollah, the people who had been the umbrella group holding all the Western hostages. I remember that sense of being absolutely sort of thinking this something could go wrong again. Mm. And luckily it didn't. I've been back many times. One always has that sort of sense of things could bubble up again, and clearly, tragically, in Afghanistan, it does keep bubbling up. Lebanon, although always very volatile, and they've just managed to form a government, as it happens there, for the first time in a year or something. That's part of some of the interest in those places that continues for those of us who've got to know Afghanistan or Lebanon a bit with me, that you can never be sure quite how the world will be, and there are beautiful places to be, lovely people, and yet there's this undercurrent or undertow, perhaps, of a potential danger.
Completely. And I'm actually very impressed that you could go back, because I cannot go back. Yeah. I physically can't do it. Yeah. And in fact, I describe in my book, in 2013, My boss at the time said, would I like to go back to Afghanistan to go down to Helmand to see how the British troops were getting on. And it was a NATO-organized trip, and he said, don't worry, you know, it'll be pretty straightforward. And I said yes, but my body said no. And I immediately started to re-experience all the trauma symptoms that I'd battled with years before. And for about 2 days it went on until my wife, who's sitting in the audience here, actually said, you are not going, full stop. And I went back to see the editor and I said, look, you know, my mind wants to go to Afghanistan, but my body won't let me. And he said, that's no problem whatsoever. You're not going. And as soon as I walked out of his office, I could feel it all ebbing away again. So very sadly, Afghanistan's one place in this world that I cannot go back to.
But you've written about it in the most extraordinary way, a brilliant way. I mean, I know it's with pain, but the sensitivity to the place, but especially to the people and what they went through and tragically are continuing to go through. Ed, thank you so much, well, for joining me and all of us today. It's lovely to meet you.
My pleasure.
We met actually once on a yacht at Cowes Week, and we were both part of the press corps on the press yacht. If you like, and it was incredibly windy, and I wasn't terribly experienced at sailing, but it's just a mad story. But the captain of this press yacht, who was obviously getting sponsored by, I think it was Volvo, who was sponsoring the whole Cowes Week, was sort of getting lots of money because he was the press yacht and therefore had all these amateurs on his boat. But he wasn't going to give up on racing the other big ships, and these were 65-foot yachts. So it was, and there was very heavy weather, so the boat was tacking from side to side and tipping it massively. And all the amateurs on board were just bundled about, and he was trying to get his burly young men crew to shift us all about. It was absolutely terrifying. So that's the last time we met, and we survived that ordeal. But it's been lovely to meet you again.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you all very much. Oh, and Ed will be signing copies of... You can get a copy of Death of the Translator, and I think it's just over there, and Ed will be very happy to sign that for you. But thank you all very much for coming and hearing us. Thank you.